Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. When we recite the precepts like this, so today half moon day, the lay community take the refuges, three refuges, the eight precepts. So similarly on the other major lunar days, the new moon and full moon, then the bhikkhus, we recite the Patimokkha, the 227 precepts of our training, and then the novices, the samaniras, recite the 10 precepts of their training. Similarly for the anagarikas, the 8 precepts. So sometimes when we reiterate or take the precepts, reaffirm the precepts in this way, then sometimes we use language like of purifying the sila. And in the last line of that little verse that's recited at the end, Tasama silang we saw daye, thus should our precepts be purified, or therefore should our precepts, our conduct, our virtuous conduct be purified. The verse, as you can read in the chanting books, is, yeah. These are the 8 precepts, they are the vehicle for happiness, for peacefulness, for true wealth, true well-being, true pleasure, bhoga sampada. Therefore, let the precepts be purified, visodaye. So it's interesting sometimes to contemplate this principle of visuddhi, of purity or purification, like the visuddhi magga, the path of purification. And it's good to contemplate that and to consider, well, what is purification? What is purified? What really can be purified? And how are we thinking of that? So if we think in terms of I am an impure person, I've done a whole variety of different things, I've said things, I've acted and spoken, thought things that have made me into an impure person, polluted with this, that or the other defilement, kilesa, and then taking the precepts, reiterating the precepts, then that makes me pure again. And then over the next fortnight or the next week, then along with the wholesome actions, the kusala kamas, then there's all kinds of unwholesome akusala kamas get done, and then we pile up a whole accretion of impurities. And then when we take the precepts, then we wipe those all out again. So we can think of it in those terms. And that's a sort of very Catholic model also. You know, you pile up a whole load of sins of various types, and you go to the priest and you do your confession, you get absolved, and you know, after 25 Hail Marys or whatever, and then you've got your cleansing, and you can walk away ideally feeling or being actually so cleansed of all of those impurities or negativities. Well, it's an understandable enough model, and sometimes the language can suggest that's the actuality of it. But it's also It's good for us to investigate and to consider, but when we do investigate and look at that, explore that, we begin to realize that's a somewhat simplistic or childish, childlike take on things. Or it's one way of describing things from a superficial point of view. Rudimentary point of view. One other way that we can hold the precepts, or we can think of this, is rather than there being a person who's got a whole pile of that is the owner of a whole pile of negative karma in an absolute sense, and that taking the precepts then purifies that. Far more skillful it is to see that the taking the precepts, reaffirming the precepts, is a recognition of, yeah, there is good and bad action and there is its results. This is one of the bases of right view, mundane right view. Yes, there is good and bad action, wholesome and unwholesome action, and it has its results. Yeah, the wholesome action has pleasant results, unwholesome action has painful results. Yeah, this is the fact of nature. And the taking the precepts is more of a recognition that yes, there are unwholesome actions that have been taken, and they have a painful result, and there are wholesome actions that have been taken, they have a pleasant result. Therefore, I take this opportunity to set the intention to cultivate wholesome actions, so that this is when we recite the refuges, the precepts. This is really what we're doing is restating an intention, or clarifying an intention to live in a wholesome and restrained way. And then in the eight precepts, along with the basic moral precepts of not killing, not stealing, and so forth, there's also the renunciant precepts of that we'd undertake for, a day or during the stay, just visiting the monastery for the day, or if we're staying here for a few days, the duration of our time in the monastery, or if one's undertaken to live here long term, then it's saying this is a standard of simplicity of renunciation that I also choose to live by. This is a standard of conduct that I wish to hold up and use as a guide for cultivating the cultivation of wholesome states. So that's quite a different model than the, I'm an impure person and I need to get rid of my impurities. And when I got rid of my impurities, then I'll be a purified person. It's a somewhat different model. And it might seem kind of indistinguishable, but if you reflect and use the powers of investigation to explore that, you see, well, it is, it's very, very different. Because the second way of talking about it and thinking about it doesn't take that sense of a person here who is the owner in an absolute way of action and its results. It's just seeing that there are these processes that are experienced here within the citta, within the heart, and there are actions that can be taken, decisions that can be made, but there's no absolute fixed sense of person, of the I, me, mine, that's the doer, the agent, the experiencer, the actor. So along with your mundane right view of that there is good and bad action and its results, there's a supramundane right view, which is really basically the cultivation of insight, the cultivation of wisdom. The seeing through that all action, all perception, all formations, physical formation, mental formations, these are devoid of self or that which belongs to a self. They are fundamentally ownless. They're all simply attributes of the natural order, mental, physical, subtle, coarse, interior, exterior, however we describe it, the different places of the spectrum of experience. These are all just factors, facets of Dhamma, of the nature of the way things are. It's not an individual person. It's not a fixed, separate, independent I that is the doer and the receiver of good and bad action. So it's a subtle distinction again, but it's very important and helpful to see in that way. It's very easy just to take our superficial and conditioned view of I'm a person and I am these particular characteristics. I'm a layperson, I'm a monastic, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm a woman, I'm a man. Taking those as absolute fixed realities. It's just, you know, ordinary common day, common everyday experience and habits of speech and perceptions. Take those qualities and uses them as the ways of designating the world without question. But of course, I'm a monk. Of course, I'm a man. Of course, I'm a woman. Of course, I'm a lay person. Of course, I'm tall. Of course, I'm short. Because those are just the common distinctions that we use every day. There's kind of ordinary, everyday perceptions, comparative ways of ranking, measuring, sorting the world out. But if we wish to genuinely realize the true nature of all things, and to genuinely, truly free the heart from all confusion, to truly purify the heart, to arrive at the quality of true purity, purification, then there needs to be a purification of view, as well as a purification of sila. There needs to be that a clarification of, yes, there is that ordinary conventional view of things, that the relative view of things, but there's also a more fundamental view, a more absolute, ultimate view. And in that view, then, that we see that inside, outside, self, other, monastic, layperson, Buddhist, non-Buddhist, woman, man, old, young, long-term, short-term, arriving, leaving, good, bad, these are conventions that it's impossible to have any fundamental substance. They cannot have any fixed substantial reality. It cannot be. So our everyday speech and perceptions don't support that. It's really just in the stillness of focused reflection, focused meditation, the peace of samadhi, the clarity of insight, that reveals that deeper layer, the layer of truth beyond the conventional perceptions. But in our ordinary everyday thinking and feeling, then it's a matter of fact. Yes, I'm a confused person, or I'm a calm person. I have got a lot of defilements, and I need to get rid of them. And not having defilements, it feels good. I'm a person who's got problems, or I'm a person who's got defiled thoughts, or I'm a person who has this kind of accomplishment or this kind of quality. Now, as long as we take that as a fixed reality, that I'm a person who needs to be purified, or I'm a person who needs to get rid of their problems. I'm a person who can't meditate very well, and then when I can meditate, I'll be a person who's a good meditator, or I'll be a person without problems. And won't that be good? Certainly, being a person without problems is more attractive than being a person with problems. Being a person who can concentrate as being a person who, as opposed to a person who can't. It seems a lot more attractive, and certainly within the Buddha's teachings, he says, kusala kamma, wholesome action, is certainly more praiseworthy and of conventional value and conventional worth than unwholesome action and confused action and speech. unwholesome action and speech. Certainly that's the case. But if we let that value system creep in and be the sole defining way, then we always find there's this barrier within our hearts. We find this quality of limitation and frustration. This quality of sterility we can find in the practice, always trying to become pure and never really quite achieving it, always being afraid that there's that I've got some impurity, or I can't quite get it right, or I'm not quite good enough. I'm basically not clear, I'm not wise, I'm not good. And that those attitudes fence the heart in, create a quality of limitation, of sterility, of burdenedness, so a burdening of the heart. And we can try with great sincerity, great effort, and burn the midnight oil, hours and hours of walking meditation, sitting meditation, diligent Dharma study, and kind of good-hearted effort, trying to be an unselfish person. I'm a selfish person. I need to be unselfish. I'm not compassionate enough. I need to be more compassionate. And we can try really hard to develop all these wholesome qualities, and then it can be bewildering and frustrating after sort of many years of trying to be a good person, trying to do all the right things. And we have maybe we can collect a huge CV of goodnesses, that developing compassion and developing generosity and developing concentration and developing good behavior and good speech. But as long as it's held in the context of, I am an impure person who needs to be purified, I'm an imperfect person who needs to be perfected, there keeps being that experience of limitation and frustration, of blandness, of barrenness, of burdenness. This is how it is for most people. Well, one of the things that's happening in this is that we're in a way, there is more purification necessary, but what's needed to be purified is the purification of the heart of the one of the more subtle kinds of clinging. So we can focus upon kama upadana, like the clinging to sense pleasure, karma, or clinging to becoming, ba'a, or clinging to views and opinions, clinging and ditto upadana, or clinging to conventions, sila bhattu padana. And we can try very hard to be seeing those aspects of clinging and dispelling them. But sometimes the most subtle of all the four types of clinging, and the Buddha's classical list of these, kind of sneaks through. And this is the atavada upadana, the clinging to the feeling of I, atavada. Like Theravada means the way of the elders, atavada means the way of the self. Atavada upadana, the clinging to the way of I. And what this is pointing to is that subtle contextualizing of experience of I'm a meditator, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, I'm a person with impurities who needs to be purified, imperfections that need to be perfected. The I am. And the problem is also that we can gather evidence from the material world that, yeah, but I am a confused person who needs to be unconfused. I am a bad meditator, and I do need to learn how to meditate. And it says here in the books, keep saying over and over in the suttas, here you have training the mind to be free of the hindrances of sense desire, ill will, and laziness and so forth, dullness, restlessness, doubt, in order to acquire these states. And they're better. He says so. The Buddha says, here it is. And certainly that's true, and we can gather all kinds of evidence from our memories and our perceptions and the world around us that affirm that kind of a view, that I am an impure person, I do have defiled thoughts, and I do have rampant feelings of restlessness and lust and aggression, fear. They are there. I am like that. I'm a greedy person. I'm a lazy person. I'm a violent person. I am. I have all these violent feelings all the time. Therefore, I'm a violent person. I'm a jealous person. I'm a selfish person. I feel all these selfish thoughts all the time. Therefore, I'm a selfish person. And then the Buddha says, get rid of selfishness and you'll be happy. And the irony, or painful irony, is that yes, we can say on a conventional level that's true, but we don't realize that the thing that's most crucial to that whole mixture is the main problem, or the root problem, is not the thing that's getting all the attention. The agitation, the restlessness, the jealousy, the vindictiveness, the lust, the laziness, conceit or doubt or whatever it might be. The thing that's the root issue is the I am this kind of person. It's the I am and the person. The Sakkaya Ditti. The basic belief in the I am the body, I am the personality, becomes invisible to us. It's like an unconscious framework for the whole of our experience. It's like when we watch the mind, it's almost like the sort of container for the whole sphere of perception. That we watch different things arising and ceasing, pleasant and unpleasant, beautiful and ugly, mind states and perceptions arising and ceasing, and we don't notice that it's the whole thing is held in this embrace of I am the meditator, I am the doer, I am the owner of all of these things. And even in some of the daily reflections that we have, like on the five subjects of frequent recollection, I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma, whatever karma I shall do, of that I will be the heir. Thus we should frequently recollect. We say, yeah, well, we recite this all the time. The Buddha told us to remember this. I am the owner of my karma. I am. But what we're missing in that is that we reflect on that way. We reflect in that way, yes, to recognize the results of good and bad action, but also to then prepare the ground for the next level, having established that mundane right view, then it prepares us for the heart for the next level of the super mundane right view, or the absolute right view of there is no person who is the owner of karma, the doer, the heir to the karma. That the conceit of I am, the whole creation of the I am feeling, is another mental formation. It's not anything that's substantially real or solid. So that we have to, but there has to be an acknowledgement, a true openness to the workings of karma and the acceptance of that pattern in order to be genuinely able to go to the next step, realized of, oh, but yes, there is a result in good and bad action, but and it's a kind of mysterious way that it works, where that it's by acknowledging that sense of I am the owner, or and then we see that, well, actually that's not really the perfect way of speaking about it or holding it. It's more like this happens here, this is known here, this is experienced here. So that can be invisible to us, though, and we can have this whole I am the doer, I'm the meditator, I'm the experiencer, of this sort of solid wall of I am, of Sakkaya Ditti, of Asmimana, of personality view, of the conceit of identity, walling the whole thing in, being the bubble, the bubble chamber that is the container of the whole thing, all the bubbles of inside, outside, beautiful, ugly, wholesome, unwholesome. It's all bubbling around within that. But we don't realize that the whole thing is contained within these, you know, subtle boundaries of this is all me and mine, this is who and what I am. And so that this is one of the reasons why we can never really experience purity or purification, or there's always that sense of impurity or incompleteness or frustration or limitation, is because we're not noticing, it's not being appreciated, that conceit of I am, the obstruction of the jitta, of the heart, caused by personality view, is sort of sneaking through unnoticed, is creating a limitation in a totally unnoticed way. This is why in many of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, for years and years he's been stressing this, and if you look at there's Dhamma talks in different books like Jitta Viveka or The Way It Is, or particularly in his most recent book, Intuitive Awareness, so soon to be appearing in an expanded edition, Wisdom Publications, under the title The Sound of Silence, over and over and over and over again. It's extraordinary the number of times he repeats it. It says, to be thinking, I've got to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future. I'm an impure person now who's got to get rid of their impurities, then I'll be a pure person. It says, all of this is just compounding personality view, Sakkaya Ditti. And the more that we believe in that, then the more we're creating an obstruction. We're creating, compounding the hindrances, compounding the fetters. We're kind of bolting the fetters on even more firmly than ever before. And so in our meditation and in the genuine process of purification, along with the need to live in an honorable way and to be restrained in our speech, honest and gentle, respectful in speech and action, that the next layer of purification is that purification of the heart from self-view, from that kind of conceit of identity. And the conceit of time, the conception of time. I've got to do something now. I'm an unenlightened person. I've got to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future. And again, we can quote dozens and dozens, hundreds of suttas, passages, where the Buddha says, yeah, it's like, yes, do something now. If you do this now, then that, you know, the result will be enlightenment. See, and we can point at the page and the references, and that's true, it is true. But the problem comes then if we take that to be an absolute truth, then right in this moment we're blocking the heart's realization of Dhamma here and now, the timeless Dhamma, akaliko Dhamma, the pachupana Dhamma, the Dhamma of the here and now. It's one of the reasons why we in the chanting we recite the qualities of Dhamma, sanditiko, akaliko, ehipasiko, apparent here and now, timeless, akaliko, opanaiko, leading inward, leading onward, pachatang viditabo vinyuhi, pachatang, to be seen by each wise person for themselves. Akaliko, it's now. It's this Dhamma, the Dhamma is here now. So rather than thinking of, I haven't got the Dhamma, I haven't got enlightenment, I need to do something now, this person needs to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future, then I'll be an enlightened person. Won't that be great? I'm an impure person now, I've got to get rid of my impurities, now I'll be a purified person in the future. Won't that be great? And yet the biggest obstruction, or the most subtle and deep obstruction to that process, is the very I am a person. That's self-view, personality view, Sakkaya Ditti, Sat, true or real, kaya, body or person, ditti, view, the view of the real person, the view of the real body, the view of the real form. So as we then notice that and recognize that, and just hear the mind saying that, reiterating that conception, and challenging it, just not going along with it, refusing to take it to be true. And sometimes just to clarify, just even state that to it out loud in our minds, this is a really useful practice. Just to say, I am an unenlightened person, and I need to do something now to become enlightened in the future. And then noticing that little murmur in the heart, that bright quiver in the heart that says, there's something wrong with that. That's ridiculous. That doesn't sound quite right. And maybe that murmur is an extremely quiet murmur. But it's here. That's the intuitive wisdom. It's the natural wisdom of the heart that says, yeah, you know, the Dhamma is here already. It's not like the Dhamma is somewhere else. It's some sort of ethereal quality somewhere else. Dhamma is nature. So nature is that kind of green stuff out there. Or the stars in the sky, or the moon, the half moon arcing across the sky. That's nature. Or the crickets ringing, or the frogs in the river. That's nature, the rocks and the Mendocino dust. No, the nature is everything. It's your mind, your body, and all its attributes. We can't get away from nature. Everything that we are is that. Dhamma is not somewhere else. Apparent here and now. Timeless. Sanditiko akaliko. Top of the list. Apparent here and now. Timeless. So what we see is that by recognizing that is a conception, a conceit, the I am an unenlightened person, I'm an impure person who needs to be purified, seeing that is just another mental formation, it's an attitude, it's a mental construct that comes into being, arises and passes away. And then in seeing that, recognizing, oh, this is a thing that comes into being, and then training the heart to make that an object of insight meditation, of investigation. Seeing that for what it is, another impermanent condition. Then we're letting go of the self-conceit. The personality view is being penetrated, is being illuminated. Its intrinsic insubstantiality is revealed. It's transparent. It's insubstantial. No substance. The conceit of I am, asmimana, the I am feeling, ahankara, mamankara, made of I-ness, made of mindness, that I am feeling, that mind feeling, this is my body, my mind, I am this. These are feelings, they're just perceptions, mental formations that arise, come into being, cease. The feeling of self is not self. That which knows the feeling of self is not self. So there's a relaxing into that. So it's not, and there's a recognition in that moment of relaxing, of that transparency being known. There's a relaxation of the heart, and we can say that the heart expands, but the heart doesn't really expand. It's just like the limiting barriers that have been believed in are seen as empty, so that the false limitation is recognized in its true nature as being false. So it's not really that the heart expands, but the heart has always been limitless beyond space and time. But that limitlessness is realized. That timelessness is realized. So rather than, and Dhamma is somewhere else, and you've got to kind of get to it and realize it and become it, become one with Dhamma, that's this ethereal stuff somewhere else. It's realizing that this has always been the fundamental nature of our own heart, our own nature. This is, how could it be otherwise, really? So that with the falling away of those obstructions, clinging to perception, clinging to feelings of pain or pleasure, clinging to feelings of success or failure, purity or impurity, as those are seen as transparent, then that the presence of the Dhamma is awakened to. So in a way, a lot of what meditation is, in its deepest essence, is allowing the heart to awaken, encouraging the heart to awaken to its own nature. Allowing the Dhamma to awaken to its own nature. And then when that comes about, when that is realized, then there's, you can say, well, that's purification. It's kind of real purification. But it's purification, not because there was a person who was polluted who has now become unpolluted, or a person who was unenlightened who's become enlightened. It's more that that intrinsic purity that was always there has never been anywhere else but here. That intrinsic purity has been realized. That intrinsic perfection, completeness, has been realized. It never wasn't there, but it was because of attachment to views and perceptions, ideas of self, feelings of self, then that intrinsic purity was rendered invisible, obscured, occluded, and not known. In the sutta, the relay of chariots, that is the source of Buddha Ghosa's book, the structure of Buddha Ghosa's book, The Path of Purification, the different stages or different sections of the book are divided up according to the divisions of the Ratinivitta Sutta, the relay of chariots. And this is a discourse where two bhikkhus meet together, Sariputta and Puna Mantaniputta meet. And then Sariputta is asking Puna Mantaniputta, you know, the reason why he practices is, well, do you practice for the purification of virtue? And he says no. And then he goes through these, well, do you practice for the purification of concentration? And goes through these different levels of concentration, of view, of and so forth, so on and so forth, through seven different levels. And it's all the way up to, you know, do you practice for the purification and of the heart, for knowledge and vision of the way things are, or for the liberation of the heart? And he says no to all of these, and then he says, well, finally, after he says no to all these different levels of going from the most mundane, which starts off with the purification of conduct and speech, all the way up to the purification of freedom, of liberation. Still, Puna Mantani Buddha says, no, it's not that. That's still not the whole story. And then Sariputta finally says, well, what is it that you what is it the reason that you practice? For what purpose do you practice? And he says, for the utter realization of Nibbana, free from all clinging, anupadisesa Nibbana. That's the reason that he practices. You know, all these other stages talking about about conduct, about view, about different types of liberation. He says these are all sort of partial or relative. But the point of the whole thing is the utter realization of Nibbana and freedom from all clinging, without the realization of Nibbana without remainder. Anupadisesa Nibbana, become complete. Limitless realization of Nibbana, utterly free of all clinging. And then Sariputta says, very good, very good. This is marvelous. This is indeed profound wisdom. That, you know, this is the reason why you practice and all the others are not that. And he says, oh, why do you say this? He says, well, it's rather like if you want to send, the king wants to send a message from Rajagaha to Sarvati, you know, then to get the message there as quickly as possible, then the king uses a relay of chariots, and they pass, you know, one chariot, when the horses are getting tired, they pass the message on to the next charioteer, and the next, and the next, and the next, so that the way to get the message quickest from one city to the other, from Rajagaha to Sarvati, then it's passed from one chariot to another. So similarly, in this way, in starting off, the first chariot is the purification of conduct, and then to the next, in purification of concentration, and, you know, each of these chariots is sort of one stage of the process. But, you know, the message hasn't reached its goal until there is the utter nibbana without any clinging whatsoever. And so Sariputta says, oh, this is really great. This is highly admirable. Well done, Venerable. And so then Puna says, well, it's nice that you congratulate me in this way, but, you know, you didn't actually introduce yourself. So, you know, who are you? I've been enjoying this Dhamma discussion. You know, so to whom have I been speaking? He says, oh, my name's Upatissa. He says, Upatissa? You mean you're the Venerable Sariputta? He says, yeah, that's right. What? I've been discoursing on Dhamma to the great Venerable Sariputta. So immediately says, oh, please, you know, I didn't mean to sort of be so casual with you or to sort of talk in an offhand way, you know. Forgive me if I wasn't being respectful. And Sariputta says, well, you know, you were plenty respectful, and, you know, your wisdom is very acute and keen. So even though I am sort of have the position of being the Buddha's chief disciple, don't worry that you were speaking out of turn or being too casual. You know, you are great wise being and worthy of equal respect. So they go sort of patting each other on the back. There's a wonderful little sutta, the Relay of Chariots, and it describes this that structure of of purification. You know, obviously Buddhaghosa took that structure to define his the progress of purification. And so it's a helpful model and an interesting sutta, useful sutta to explore and to look at. That each stage, you know, is appropriate and necessary, but it's rather like if we get stuck at the stage of purifying our concentration or purifying our views and opinions, purifying our conduct, and it's like you've only got to the third chariot, then the message stops there. And it doesn't make it all the way to the destination. And so when the message is carried all the way through and we bring the process of our practice to completion and to fulfillment, then where it arrives is at the utter nibbana, free of all attachment, free of all clinging, that utter peacefulness of the heart, that utter liberation of the heart, that's gone beyond words, beyond ideas, beyond expression, and without any kind of limitation whatsoever, complete and utter nibbana. And that's the purpose of it all. That's the goal. And that when we are when we have that in mind, we know that in mind, then we are much more able to recognize the sort of stages along the way and know them just as stages. And know that, yeah, this is just a part of the process of realization, but it's not complete, it's not fulfilled until there is that utter realization, the heart free of all time, all identity, all limitation, all obstruction, where even ideas of self or other don't apply anymore. Time doesn't apply, place does not apply. And this is what the teaching points us to, and that is the culmination of purification, the culmination of the the whole practice, where the path leads to. So I offer these thoughts for reflection this evening.